Skull, everybody. This is Alexander Ludwig, and you are listening to The Wild Hunt.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to The Wild Hunt, the No Ship Network podcast on the History Channel series Vikings. I am your host, Steve.
And I am your host, Em.
And you just heard Alexander Ludwig, a.k.a. Bjorn Ironside, give us the intro, and that is courtesy of the fine people over at the TV Time app. You guys should go check it out. It lets you keep in touch with when all your favorite TV shows are coming out. You can get part of a community and discuss, talk, critique TV shows, all that stuff. Really cool app. Check it out. And if you're interested in what we're doing right now, right here, go to www.noship.net and check out all of the other stuff that we do. You can check out every other TV show that we podcast on. You can become a member and hear exclusive content. You can support us financially if you're so inclined. But even if you don't do any of that stuff, go over to iTunes and give us a review. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. So we are finally back. It seems like it took forever to get here.
Yeah. It's been a long year.
Yeah. It has been a long and tough year. And let's go ahead and just get this out of the way real quick before we actually delve into the show. Em and I have had a crazy year. Especially there's been deaths in the family. There's been a lot of rigmarole otherwise, and there's been a lot of changes in our work schedule. I've taken on a second job, but more importantly, Em has gotten a new boss, and the boss has restructured the schedule somewhat. And long story short, our work schedules are interfering with our podcasting is what's going on. These damn work schedules, you know, trying to make money. So at the end of the day, the only solution that we could come up with on a day to podcast is a day that Paul could not commit to. So what's going to happen is he is going to kind of drop in every now and then according really to when he can be available to do a podcast. So he's still watching the show. He's still part of No Ship Network, but he can't commit to the Friday night or the Friday evening recording schedule. So he's going to just kind of come and go when he can do it. So that's why you're not hearing him tonight. He actually wanted to do tonight, but he was sick and he didn't want Em to have to edit out 2.5 hours of sniffling. So, all right. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get into it.
All right. We are discussing Vikings Season 5, Episode 1. Depending on where you look, this is known as either The Fisher King or The Departed Part 1. This episode was written by Michael Hurst and directed by David Wellington. David Wellington has directing credits towards shows such as Orphan Black, Queer as Folk, and Kids in the Hall. Before we start breaking down this recap, which I did break down by characters, starting with Ivar, Steve's going to give a little synopsis of The Fisher King.
So, The Fisher King. In Arthurian legend, the Fisher King, or the Wounded King, is the last in a long line with charged with keeping the Holy Grail. Versions of this story vary widely, but he is always wounded in the legs or groin and incapable of moving on his own. In the Fisher King legends, he becomes impotent and unable to perform his tasks himself, and he also becomes unable to father or support a next generation to carry on after his death. So I think it's pretty obvious who we're talking about here.
It actually really comes up more in part two about how he feels about his condition. But I think it's starting to set a tone, at least for how we should be thinking of Ivar this season. Okay, so the opening of this episode begins with the recently departed Ragnarsson's funeral rite. That would be Sigurd, my favorite Ragnarsson of last season. Ivar appears remorseful about Sigurd's death.
What do you think? Do you honestly believe that he's remorseful for this?
I don't, actually. But Alex, who Anderson said in an interview on the Vikings podcast, that he believes that Ivar is indeed remorseful about killing Sigurd. I don't care what he says, though. I find it debatable.
I feel like it's revisionist history on his part. I feel like it's one of those things when people get caught cheating and they're not sorry they did it. They're sorry they got caught. So he's not sorry that he acted the way he acted. Yeah, maybe he's a little bit sorry that his brother's dead now that his head has had time to cool down. And he's like, oh, crap, I killed my brother, one of, you know, the king's son. So maybe perhaps not remorsefulness is the word, but regret that he got hot-headed and did it.
Yeah, I mean, because there's some other moments where he could actually show remorse again, but he doesn't.
Yeah,
so, or at least my interpretation is that he doesn't. So, but I have things to say about that. So we'll just get into that then, which is actually coming up right here. Because later on, Ivar tries to convince Ube and Fitzurk that Sigurd made Ivar kill him.
Oh, yeah. Now, this is just classic diversionary tactic, like deflecting the blame. And not diversionary, but you're just deflecting the blame off onto somebody else. Like, I wasn't the one who was acting badly. Or you're going, okay. I did act badly, but it wasn't my fault. It was, they made me do it. They right. made me do it. So, you know, and that's kind of the hallmark of a child's way of thinking of things. So even though he kind of proves himself out to be a pretty decent tactician when it comes to their plans laying out, you know, in the future, he still has a certain mentality where he's like, nuh-uh, you know, like a kid.
Yeah, because I do think, well, his defense about it is that he claims that Sigurd was taunting him and spreading lies about him. And this is where I actually start to gain some respect for Fitzurk, because last season he was known as plus one because he just kind of glommed on and didn't do a whole lot. But he actually attempts to nail Ivar down at this moment by asking him what lies.
Yeah, we know what, you know, he was saying about you, and it's true. So, yeah.
So, like Sigurd, Fitzurk seems to prefer to cut through Ivar's bullshit, but overall, Fitzurk is much more agreeable when it comes to Ivar, which is why he's still alive for now.
I think Fitzurk is agreeable because it's a half and half proposition. He does agree with the wisdom of the ideas that Ivar's putting forth, mm-hmm. but I think he's also somewhat just like, whatever, as long as I get to have my free time to go whore around, I'm good, you know? Because I feel like every one of Ragnar's sons, like it's almost like when he died, or before he died, really, but in them is a little bit of each one. So yeah. Ivar has that ruthless passion and like brutality. I think that Ube has that patience.
Yes.
And that kind of burning will to just like go, okay, it's smoldering underneath the surface. And then of course I think that Fitzurk got his lusty side to where, you know, he just wants to kind of lay around and play with the lamb and then go sleep with women and, you know, things like that. But that's how I kind of see him. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm jumping to conclusions here.
I think he's kind of more like the junior version of sitting back and taking in information and then making decisions, where Ragnar used to do it behind partitions and woven room dividers and things like that. So I think Fitzurk kind of does that a little bit.
Okay, I can go with you on that.
But with Ube, he points out that the trigger that actually inspired Ivar's murder of Sigurd was that Sigurd called Ivar out for not being a man, mm-hmm. not being a real man. And Ivar responds with a, what would you have done? To which I was intensely interested for that second, because I wanted to know what Ube was going to say in response. But Ivar finished his sentence by insulting Ube instead with a, if you were a real man.
He's trying to deflect away. He doesn't want the conversation to keep going towards the fact that he's impotent. And that's where it was heading. That's obviously what's meant by the whole thing of like, you're not a real man. And so by asking him and then finishing it and insulting him back, he's kind of putting a cap on the conversation and going, all right, I did it. He made me do it. Fuck you guys. Let's move on.
And I guess Ivar saw the fact that Ube brought this comment back into the light as an attack, you know, mm-hmm. and he responded in kind. So it does not really improve relations, nor does it bode well for their future as brothers. And Ivar continues to absolve himself of full responsibility by saying anger overcame him. His anger blame is where I really have a problem with his supposed remorse. It is very much like when someone apologizes and then follows up with a but. You either own it or you don't. The anger blame is not only a way for Ivar to eschew responsibility, but it is also a way to characterize himself as exceptional, as if he is the only human challenged by their own anger. Therefore, he should be given leeway, if not license, to behave as he has over and over again.
Yeah, I agree completely, 100%, because what you're doing, in effect, is you're saying, okay, this is bad behavior, and I recognize that, but I'm carving out an exemption for myself, and, you know, because I'm one of Ragnar's sons, because I was angry, because it was Tuesday. You're always going to be able to come up with a reason to do behavior like that, to engage in behavior like that, if you allow yourself, so...
Yeah, that mythology he constructs around himself is the reason why he is unable to control his anger, because he has already let himself off the hook.
Agreed.
I do like the fact that Ube brought up what Sigurd had said, because it is like Sigurd gets one last jab at Ivar beyond the grave, because Ivar struck out at Sigurd trying to wipe those words away, and yet they still ring out.
Yeah, you can kill the messenger, but what they were trying to say is going to stick around forever. And I don't know if this kind of wisdom was around at this point. We understand it in modern day, even though we still don't really adhere to it. But, you know, you can try to make the messenger of something that you don't want to be out there look bad all day long. But once it gets out there in people's heads, they have to make their own decision on it. And that's a really good point. His words still are having resonance.
Yeah, it's too bad that he didn't have a lot of guidance. I mean, we're supposed to assume that Floki gave him quite a bit, but Floki was gone as much as Ragnar was.
Yeah.
So I don't know if Ivar really knows what it means to be a real man outside of sexual prowess.
Well, he was supposed to not have been taught how to be a real man, quote unquote, by Floki, but rather the Viking ways. That's what his mother wanted from Floki, was to teach him to be a real Viking.
Mm-hmm.
So whether or not you consider that to be synonymous with man in a kind of macho thing, I don't know, where it just kind of boils down to, can you fight and fuck, you know, and then nothing else. But Vikings are a lot more complex than that. So
yeah, I just don't think he has a clear path towards that.
I would agree with that, though. Yeah, I would agree with that statement.
Where Ube and Fitzurk did get to go with their father, at least, and be exposed to...
They got to travel. They got to almost be like Air Force brats in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, you have some kids who grow up in the same town, and then you've got other kids who lived in 20 different places. So your perspectives vary greatly.
So after Ivar's apology, he leaves the room. Ube says to Bjorn that he can't let Ivar lead the Great Army. Bjorn says that is on Ube and Fitzurk because he's heading back to the Mediterranean and bringing Halfdan with him. King Harald asks if Bjorn will first stop in Kattegat. Bjorn does not intend to stop there. So King Harald offers to bring all the good news to Lagertha for Bjorn. And at this, Bjorn asks King Harald to tell Lagertha and Torvi that he thinks of them.
Isn't that nice?
It's interesting, and the purposeful leaving out of Astrid, I think, has to do with the fact that, you know, she's his mistress, but the effect of it is something we should discuss when we get to part two.
Okay. Yeah. You don't get too much of Bjorn in either one of these two episodes. I don't think he's in the second episode at all, if I remember correctly. And then he's scarcely in this episode. There's just not a whole lot of him. And I mean, he's got a hard-on for hummus. In a big way. You know what I mean? He wants to get back to the Mediterranean as fast as he can. And he's just like, hey, that little shit is you guys' problem. You know what I mean? You're his brothers. I'm just kind of like your brother type of thing. I'm often, he's washed his hands of the whole situation completely. I really can't say that I blame him, because if faced with a choice, if I had his status in that culture, I would want to go off and seek out new lands and new riches and new conquests and glory and whatever have you, rather than stay in England and fight the same old enemies to just this bloody grind year after year after year. So
I wouldn't say it's spoilery, but that Vikings podcast I had mentioned earlier, they also interview Alexander Ludwig, and it teases something to come. And I don't want to say what it is just because it kind of walks that line.
Okay,
but
all right.
If those of you don't shy away from things such as that, I advise you to check it out, because it's definitely gotten me a little bit excited about what's going to happen later this season. So the scene ends with a look transpiring between Ube and Fitzurk, and it seems the weight of Ivar is on their minds.
And Ube's doing a good job of channeling his father in that way, the way he's just kind of looking. He's on a his eyes are fixed on a point in the distance, and he's just kind of staring at it. It reminds you of Travis Fimmel's turn as Ragnar. So
yeah, I think I was, out of the Ragnarsons, I think I was the most sympathetic towards Ube this particular episode. So the next time we see Ivar is when he discovers Floki with his one-man boat. Ivar, learning of Floki's imminent departure, he shows some vulnerability. I initially found myself doubting this display of emotion as wholly genuine, and maybe more, actually, I think I felt it was more manipulative. However, I do believe Ivar when he says he doesn't want Floki to leave because he will be too lonely. The reason is Floki and Auslaug were the only ones that encouraged his strange behavior. So now he must feel that he has lack of support, at least at this point in the episode. We haven't had that conversation about York yet with Fitzurk and Ube.
It's a good point to bring up, though, because you think about, he lost his mother. Lagertha killed her. He just got close to his dad, got to know him as an adult, you know, adult to adult. And then his dad dies. Floki, who's been his teacher, his mentor, like that cool uncle that he has, is gone. He's kind of estranged from his brothers because he just killed one of them. So who does he really have if Floki leaves?
Yeah, I mean, I think Fitzurk and Ivar have a decent relationship, but he and Ube, is they can't seem to talk to each other without it being barbed.
Yeah, there's way too much antagonism going on between the two of them. It's unhealthy. And when you throw in the whole, it was one thing to have that kind of, it was bad enough when you had Ragnar around now, or even Bjorn around to kind of defer to and say, well, Bjorn's the older brother. He can kick all our asses combined. So let's just listen to what he has to say. With both of those guys off of the scene, now they're vying for leadership roles. So that antagonistic relationship gets ramped up even more. I like how he calls Floki's boat a toy boat. Why are you making a toy boat?
Which it does look like a toy boat in part two. At one point, which made me laugh. But anyway, so when Floki commits to his fatalistic journey before Ivar, Ivar says his heart is broken. Floki comforts him with a hug and tells him his heart will repair. Now is the time for Ivar to become the man he is meant to be. All childhood attachments have been shorn away.
Yep, it's come time to put away childish things. Be a man.
Which is a characteristic of the hero's journey. Ivar is...
Is there an anti-hero's journey?
Is that a thing? And actually that interview with Alex Hugh Anderson, he said that Ragnar was an anti-hero, emphasis on hero, where Ivar is an anti-hero, emphasis on anti.
The nuances. It's the subtle nuances of speech that do it.
Ivar now sits with his brothers, Ube and Fitzurk, discussing what's next while they feast. Ube suggests that they should claim and settle the land they have gained from Ecgbert. Ivar wants to set up camp in the north, strategically placing themselves closer to home and with their backs defensively to the coast. Like Fitzurk here, I agree with Ivar, but that agreement has a taint when you see Ivar's countenance celebrate with a villainous cast because he got Fitzurk to agree with him and not with Ube.
Yeah, it takes it down a notch. It's a good piece of it's a well-reasoned argument that he puts out there. Like, because, you know, when he looks at his brother and he's like, I'm sure you know this, but if we set up camp in the middle of the country, we're surrounded by English people, you know, our enemies. So the idea that he's putting forth about York and having, you know, the water at your back and home being just a little bit closer and the whole nine yards is really good.
Very good. Yeah.
But it does bring him down in your estimation when he gloats about it because he got the, you know, they've got a triumvirate going on right here. You know what I mean? It's like Pompey, Crassus and Caesar, you know, way back when, and they're, you know, trying to the shifting alliances and things like that. And he desperately wants to be that Caesar. And it's just kind of like, well, you know, let your argument stand on its own merit. And that's something that lets you know that he's not quite mature enough for the sole leadership position yet, because when you are a leader and you have a good idea, you let it stand on its own merit. You don't walk around with a puffed out chest going, look what I did, you know, unless you're the president. Well, I just like how Ube kind of, he goes, yeah, that's good. And he smiles like a fake smile and he gets up with his food and he leaves.
Yeah, I'm not eating with you fools anymore.
Yeah, so he doesn't try to argue back and say, I have a different, better point than that. He just kind of goes, all right, I'm done.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that Ivar's afraid to be alone, but it's really Ube who's alone.
Yeah, that's true.
And
yeah.
he's not, it seems like he's just experiencing it and letting it happen. And I think he's going to like power through it, where Ivar's trying to fight that idea. So now the next scene, we have Ivar, Ube, and Fitzurk taking a peek at York from a distance. Two local children are taken by the Norsemen so Ivar can question them. Being a recent student of his father's, Ivar asks the children when the next Christian observance was going to take place. In 3 days' time, the Christians will participate in Ascension Day, which I did look up, and this is actually when Christ ascends into heaven after resurrection. So it's the 40th day of Easter. So it occurs 39 days after Easter Sunday. So this places the timeline within summer.
Right.
I was trying to make a connection as far as like Ascension Day somehow being related to maybe Ragnar's kids, you know, kind of making their movement towards York and what they're going to, but I can't make it work. So
there's not enough meat on the bone for that one.
No. Ivar translates to his brother by showing them three fingers. It actually made me think of Inglourious Basterds because he didn't use his index finger.
Who was it that didn't do it?
So I'm assuming that that's how that's the Scandinavian way of demonstrating the numbers on their fingers.
Hmm, okay.
Let us know.
Yeah.
Because we're just assuming at this point.
Somebody figure it out and let us know.
So next we have the attack on York by the Norsemen. Ube is the one who's tasked with getting his men over the walls of York to open the gate. And he needs no ladder like the rest of them. He scales that wall.
It's like Spider-Man.
Yeah. And Ivar and Fitzurk ride through the now open gate in Ivar's chariot. The Norsemen enter the chapel and begin their slaughter. A nun kills herself and dies in a startled Ube's arms. In contrast, a dying bishop in Ivar's grasp is going to get some extra special treatment. Ivar had the bishop's cross melted down and poured into his mouth. Ivar says, as the bishop's death rattle struggles through the molten metal, now you can kiss the cross.
So we've seen this before. most recently in Game of Thrones. But this comes from a real practice. This was actually done to people. I believe it was in, when did I read about it? I could be wrong about that. It did actually happen, but it was the Europeans who would come over and get gold. So it was the Native Americans or it was the indigenous Mexicans. And they would do this to people that they caught because they felt that they were so greedy, just coming over and taking and taking and taking. Yeah. And they actually did that. They melted down gold and poured it down their throats.
Supposedly, that happened to Crassus.
Oh, wow.
Marcus Linnaeus Crassus. But there's also another account that he was beheaded and that his head was used as a prop in a play.
How embarrassing.
By the way, there's a screaming child that's being ignored because there is no Ragnar to care anymore.
That's a good point. I didn't think about that because he would have came in and took the child out, you know, and it would have been this slow motion scene of him holding it up or keeping it away from arrows flying around and, you know, beat up one of his own guys to make sure that the kid was safe.
We've got these Ragnarsons that have qualities that some we can admire, but there is something missing. And it's not just the actor Travis Fimmel that we've all grown to love, but there's some sort of goodness that he had. I think that is represented by how he felt towards children that has been sucked out. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that vacuum will get filled.
I mean, he had two children by the time he was Ube's age, you know, so I don't know what, you know, I mean, these guys just don't seem interested in having kids and, you know what I mean, carrying on the legacy and stuff like that.
But, right. Because, I mean, there was that conversation last season with Auslaug talking how they need to be married. And I mean, even after that conversation, they're still not.
They were just like, whatever, mom. It's none of your business. But like now I'm pretty sure I saw this both times I watched it, but wasn't it Fitzherk who grabbed one of the nuns, the nun that didn't kill herself, and he like lifted up her skirt to make sure she was actually a female. And then she fell down and he dragged her away by her ankle as he was smiling. And because they came up together, I believe that's what I saw.
Yeah, I remember a nun being dragged away, but I guess I didn't notice it was Fitzherk doing it. Yikes.
Yeah.
So we only had one hashtag no ship for this episode, and it was written by Christian Callahan, and he said, "Watching that church massacre was rough. Hashtag no ship."
Oh, yeah. That was nothing short of brutal. I mean, you didn't even have to get to the point where they were pouring the gold down the bishop's throat. Everything else before that, just coming into a church, unarmed people who are there to worship their God just get slaughtered. I mean, you could probably take the city without doing that. These people are probably going to be the least threatening to whatever it is that you're going to do. And you're not going to kill every last single person in there, are you? In the whole city? I mean, I'm assuming not. Maybe they do. Maybe that's the way it's just to, you know, set it all on fire and then rebuild it with your own men kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, before, you know, it was always rough to see how the Vikings would behave, especially in the early seasons, but you always had something to kind of counter it and give you a little bit of relief from all the violence, like Ragnar, for instance, or even Athelstan in some way. But
yeah.
I mean, really the only person who has any potential towards that would be Ube, but he froze. I mean, there was nothing he could do for her, but it kind of gave you he seemed startled or moved by her death.
He could be a killing machine when he needs to, but he's definitely got a human side that has compassion and caring and doesn't like senseless violence.
So after their achievement, Ivar makes a toast to York and his brothers. Ube modifies this toast by saying, "To all of the brothers, including Sigurd." Ivar scowls at this statement. Is it because he's reminded of his guilt or the unburied hatchet between Ube and him?
It's a little bit of both, I think. I think he doesn't want to be reminded of his guilt. He wants there to be smooth relationships between these guys. He wants their approval. He wants their acceptance. And he wants them to think of him as a badass who just pulled this off.
Mm-hmm.
And then he has to go, okay, now you're bringing up the dead brother and you don't want to drink with me. And you're just going to walk away. You're being a dick. You know, that's how Ivar is looking at it, I believe.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. This scene ends with Ube standing alone atop the city walls of York. And I've already mentioned how Ivar feared his loneliness when Floki was leaving, yet it is Ube who is alone.
And, you know, I noticed that if you compare, like, the Siege of Paris, for example, when Ragnar was able to get over the wall, he was looking into the city. Because he was looking at the conquest that he was about to get. Now you have Ube, who is looking the opposite way from whence they came. He was just like, I think he's trying to examine like how much he wants to do, how much he was, because, you know, in the earlier conversation they had at the dinner table, he was putting forth the idea that he was an advocate for them to be the farmers. He said, our dad wanted us to be more than raiders mm-hmm. and killers. He wanted us to have an extra quality that went forward with life so mm-hmm. future generations wouldn't have to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's true of Ragnar. He had a better vision from them. Ivar doesn't care about that. He wants to pillage and burn.
So, you know, we were talking about the characteristics that they've all inherited from their father. I think he inherited the farmer, but not the Viking. He wants to get away from that.
That's a good point. That's well put. But he inherited the farmer, not the Viking, but he's keeping the haircut.
Yeah. I mean, he definitely looks the most like Ragnar. I mean, there's long distance shots that, you know, I'm like, whoa.
Give him a couple of years and they could do the shaved head Ragnar from the last couple of seasons. Make him a little bit craggy and dirty. And I think he could pull that off.
Okay, so now we're going to discuss Haemond, who is played by Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. And we were first introduced to him in the season finale last year at the very end of that the final episode. I think we had mentioned at that time on the episode, but just as a refresher, Haemond is actually a historical figure who was a medieval bishop of Sherborne. He was consecrated between 867 and 868. He died on March 871 at the Battle of Martin. He is venerated as a saint in the Eastern Orthodox Church and Roman Catholic. So he was this warrior bishop.
Which we don't have anymore. There's no more warrior bishops.
I mean, there might be in some pockets of subcultures, maybe.
It's possible. I just haven't heard of it. Let's say that. Well, I'll just plead ignorance on that and say I haven't heard of any recently, but if they're out there, I want to know about
it. Yeah, write into us, please. Yeah. We first see Haemond this episode when he is riding into Ecgbert's stronghold with a company of men. He is determined that he and his men will find Ecgbert's body.
If I was English, I would be thrilled with this guy. I would want him on my side. I would want him to be the dude. You know what I mean? He's got the religious clout behind him, so he has the church. He's got a sword on him at all times. You know he can fuck some shit up, but you just can't. You have to keep him away from any good-looking woman, or just any decent-looking woman, for that matter.
He's and also, which we'll talk about later, he's very diplomatic in the way he speaks, so I think he's able to not only communicate well and have people listen to him, but also have people enact his suggestions as a result.
How to make friends and influence people.
In a later scene, we will see that that they do find Ecgbert's body. And in fact, it's one of Haemond's men. He lifts the lid of this enormous vat, and within is Ecgbert fully submerged in a mostly clear liquid. Was the liquid bathwater, wine, or ultra-clarified chicken broth?
Chicken broth? Let's go with the chicken broth.
Yeah, big. Put it over a fire, put some veggies.
So all we need is, what's his name? Bugs Bunny, just to come up and start cutting the carrot. What's up, Doc? I would actually go with the wine, because it almost seems like a fitting punishment. Because, I mean, if you remember, him and his buddy were getting drunk.
They were.
At the time. And they were like, it would be a shame if these pagan invaders, you know, were able to get a hold of our wine.
Well, yeah, possibly wine. I think maybe also just as likely it would be bathwater, because his Roman baths, the first time we met Ecgbert, he was in a bath.
Mm, yeah.
Not as grand. I mean, his circumstances have been reduced.
And then, you know, also it probably is just water. Because if you think about it, too, like, why it wasn't most of the wines red at the time? I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe they had a nice, what's
Chardonnay.
A Chardonnay.
I think that there's a nice touch in set design in this scene, because we have the hanging cage in the background and all the other remains of last season blending into the hazy light and shadows. It kind of just lets you know it's all of the past now. And Ecgbert's stronghold has become overrun with animals and climate, that nature persists, and that even having fathers die and sons come into ascension. So maybe that's where I can connect the ascension.
There you go.
That's nature.
I can go with it. I like it. I mean, I like the fact that they brought back those set pieces and you got to see the hanging cage again. That was a nice touch, because it, you know, that was a big part of a few episodes there towards the end, you know, when he was trapped in that cage and their conversations going back and forth and stuff. So,
yeah, it's weird how, like, the effect it had on me is it was like hanging. It was like a hanging trauma, which I don't know. I guess because I think last season was more emotional for me than I realized.
Mm. Yeah, everybody had a hard time saying goodbye to Ragnar. I mean, that's the that's what this season is going to be predicated upon. Anybody's enjoyment of it, that is how much we can enjoy this show without Travis Fimmel's Ragnar Lothbrok. And so far, after watching these first two episodes, I'd say they're not going to have a problem at all. Mm-hmm. I think they did a great, great job. So that's really, really positive, because as much faith as I have in Michael Hurst and the production team with Vikings and just Vikings in general, there's still that hanging over your head. That's a hard thing to pull off. It's like when Iron Maiden lost Bruce Dickinson, you know, it's just like, you know, but he came back. Ragnar's not coming back. So
so Haemond is next seen officiating over Ecgbert's internment. Ecgbert's funeral is followed with Haemond questioning a monk about why the Norsemen left him alive. This monk informs Haemond that the Norsemen have not been granted any land in truth and that Aethelwulf has been crowned king. Haemond is now lying prostrate in cross pose before Ecgbert's resting place. He is praying to Ecgbert, Saint Ecgbert.
Yeah, that was kind of weird to see that. Like, I know that early Christians did a lot of stuff that doesn't really fly now. You're not going to really see anybody doing that these days. But that was, I don't know if that's something that Hurst came up with or something that, you know, older Christians really did. But it looks like it would be genuine. It looks like some of that really, really devout kind of, I'm going to just get myself on the floor, spread eagle, and abase myself in front of the Lord.
That people lying prostrate makes me very uneasy when I see it. It seems to me only an evil God would want you to do that.
Yeah, it does kind of follow. It does kind of follow that. But I mean, that's how I feel looking at it. Obviously, how you feel looking at it. I think a lot of other people probably agree with that too. From a religious perspective, I could probably see, just to play devil's advocate, no pun intended, I could see people going, well, what you do is you bring yourself to the lowest possible point that you can get to say, I'm not worthy of consideration, but I beseech you to grant me my prayers and my wishes. And
but it's funny also that he's praying to Ecgbert, because we know Ecgbert and he doesn't. And we also had a scene with Ecgbert. Wait, didn't he give himself over to the devil, essentially?
Yeah. It was real. There was some ambiguity there as to, like, it didn't feel like a black mass or anything like that. But he was basically saying, look, here is my earthly goal. I don't care who I have to deal with to get it, but I'm going to fucking get it.
It was one of the best scenes on television ever, though.
It was. It was awesome.
Okay, so there's a crowd that has now gathered behind Haemond as he lies there before Ecgbert. He stands and tells the worshippers to not be afraid and that Christ is there with them, and this brings them comfort. A beautiful young woman blesses Haemond emphatically. You can see the wheels of his desire begin to turn underneath a thick layer of volition. Haemond later meets with this young woman. Her name is Aethelgith. She is praying for others when he says she should consider her own soul when she chooses to take Mass at his hands. This makes me wonder, does his statement mean that the word is out on the street of what his needs are, and that is her primary reason for summoning him?
I did not think of that, but that is probably the truth. She knows what's up, and she wants to get it on with the bishop, and, you know, he has I guess maybe he's good at what he does, you know, in the bedroom or in the church room floor, who knows?
Well, he's so venerated, maybe it's also a status thing.
Like, oh, that's
I got to hook up with Haemond.
Yeah, so even if it's not that great, you know, she could still say.
Maybe it's even religious.
Possible.
In their minds.
But like when he's given her communion, I mean, there was some serious, like, unsubtle sexual stuff going on, so.
Well, I mean, you know, it's also kind of hard not for it to be when you're putting something in somebody's mouth when they're kneeling before you. You would almost have to go out of your way to not be sexual, like have shit on your teeth or something. You know?
Well, when you go to Catholic Mass and the priest gives the host the communion, and it's a bunch of people in a row, and he's giving you this one little wafer, and some people will open their mouth and take it on the tongue. Most, you know, a lot of other people will take it in their hand and put it in their mouth themselves. The whole thing's really, not to sound like Larry David here, but the whole thing's really unsanitary. And I don't recommend it, especially during cold and flu season. But it doesn't seem sexual then, but this seemed very, very sexual with her on her knees and him, you know, she's like licking his thumb as he's doing the thing. So, yeah. There's that.
Well, at any rate, we can deduce that Haemond and Aethelgith got around to doing the deed because of his trek into that bramble forest, or is it bracken? Or
I'm not sure what it is, but it was sharp.
Yeah. And so also, you know, back to his statement about, you know, how she should be praying for her own soul because she chooses to take Mass at his hands. I think he's also saying, like, fuck you for bringing you before me because you know it's going to tempt me. And I have a hard time with this. And you're a sinner for doing that. But I think there was a lot more leeway. They could have sex at that time. So I'm not really quite sure why he's so tormented by it. I don't know that much about it. But I don't think they were because I had read another review where they had looked into this and said that bishops could actually have sex at that time.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Well, that changes the whole thing. So he's not breaking any bylaws of the church or anything like that, or rules that he's supposed to live by. He doesn't have a vow of celibacy like, you know, modern day priests do in the Catholic Church, apparently. So he's just upset with what he perceives to be immoral behavior because he's doing it with so many women, or because he can't control that urge within himself. And he seems so to be so composed and controlled in all other aspects of his life. And that's the one thing that it just can't be controlled. You know, something else takes over his libido, I guess.
Yeah, then, if that information is legit. Because if it is legit, if they were allowed to have sex, it's kind of, well, why is he so tormented by it? Why is it such an issue?
Well, you know, all things carnal in religion, you know, Western Christianity, especially Catholicism, have kind of like a negative pull to them. You know, it's
yeah, you're right.
Even a generation ago, even now, there's a lot of people who think it, but even a generation ago, there are people in my family who viewed sex as something you did simply to procreate and nothing more. And you were being, you were sinning and you were being iniquitous if you did it, even in the confines of marriage, for any other reason than to produce a child. And as you know, outlandish as we may view that, that's that. So you can only imagine going way back then.
Okay. Well, it seems like those things just come in waves. So it's not always like, it's not like this trajectory that's predictable, as far as, it's more of like, because I mean, bishops were allowed to have sex then. And then, then all of a sudden they weren't. So it actually got more conservative, not less conservative, as we tend to think of past going to towards future.
That's true. Yeah. But I think if they were allowed to have sex, it was probably most desired by the church community for them to be married to somebody and being, you know, part of like pillars of the community type thing, not having this sexy young guy who's going around with a sword banging all the, you know, widows and whatnot.
So now we're talking about Æthelwulf, who's also another very religious man, unless you had something else too. Okay. Sure. We see Æthelwulf and his family have been existing in marshlands or something else inhospitably similar. Alfred is ill and possibly at death's door. Whatever parasite Judith lays on him next, or whatever she is cooking up for him, will likely seal the deal soon. But they all look terrible, not just Alfred.
Yeah, I mean, the sky is dark. The room is dark. The food they're eating is all monotone brown color. There's no leafy greens. There's no reds. There's no nothing. It just seems like everything is just
desaturated and
right.
Everybody's smudged. It looks cold and damp.
It's England, so it is probably cold and damp.
And so far, all of this is summer. We've learned that it's summer because of the Christian holiday, but it does not look like summer, at least as far as we know it here in the United States. Now outside their hut, Judith and Æthelwulf walk together. Æthelwulf is voicing passionately his belief that their circumstances are due to their sin. Judith reacting partly to a not too distant pass of accusations and guilt trips from Æthelwulf, responds in kind with a slap and a refusal to believe that her sins are the cause of Alfred's current condition. Æthelwulf, kinder these days, replies that none of them are without sin. He leaves to pray. The camera pauses on Judith as she stands in fear and helplessness. A body is tossed onto a blazing pyre behind her. And this is another great visual that's used in this episode. And this specifically, I think, helps with building an ominous tone.
I can see why she's pissed off. I mean, you did this. This is Athelstan's kid. Do you need to be reminded about it and how bad you were as a wife and as a person and all of the other stuff she did? You know, she killed Queen Quentrith, who was pregnant at the time, and so on and so forth. So it's like, okay, so now every time it rains, you're just going to say, well, Judith, it's because you had to sleep around, you know, and God is pissed off. So I don't really blame her, you know.
But that's not what he was saying, actually, which...
No, it's not.
But he has punished her enough in the past where she has that knee-jerk reaction, like, fuck you!
It's definitely there in what he's saying. He's trying to say, well, look, none of us is without sin, so this is everybody's fault. But I know what you did for your part.
Okay, so now we're discussing Floki. We've already discussed Ivar confronting Floki in the woods about his intent with his one-man boat. The next time we see him, he is finalizing the packing up and ready to set sail. Ube and Fitzurk approach Floki and accuse him of trying to leave without saying goodbye. This is true. He was trying to do that. But Floki loves them and tells them so, and says the sons of Ragnar Lothbrok will always be close to his heart as long as he lives and breathes. Ube says his farewell and calls Floki the greatest boat builder that ever lived. Fitzurk says that Floki is beloved by the gods. Ivar attempts commanding Floki to stay, but this is only met with a jest from Floki.
He calls him a knock-kneed something. It's pretty funny because, you know, Floki's like, why don't you stand up and tell me that to my face? And you could see the smile creeping on Ivar's face, like that old, you know, back and forth between the two of them comes back so easily.
Yeah, because I feel like Floki has said that to him before. Like, I think that's been traded between them.
It's a go-to.
Yeah. So Floki's boat is interesting to me because he's got snakes as the sigil on there, which just makes me think of two things. Loki and his punishment, because his wife was having to hold the bowl over his head so that the snake venom was not consistently burning through his scalp.
Right.
And also Ragnar Lothbrok being killed in a pit of snakes.
Ah.
So, I mean, I guess Ragnar, that was Ragnar's fate. So maybe it's more, since he's being fatalistic at this point, maybe that's hit. He's offering himself up in that way. And maybe that's why he chose that sigil.
Hmm.
But he seems so linked to Loki.
Yeah.
And maybe he just sees that this, his circumstances in his life is that actual punishment.
And I mean, he did get strung up and, you know, he had to have
which is basically an interpretation of that same exact
right
scenario without the snake. It was, you know, water.
Which it seems crazy that, it, I mean, we talked about it on that podcast, but it just seems crazy that water just dripping on your head would do that, but it would.
Yeah, I think, you know, actually, the more I think about it, I think it's probably more the Loki connection, and he just sees himself as being punished, and he's embracing it. As Floki rose, heading towards the sea, the Norsemen chant, "All hail Floki." We later see Floki discovering the sunstone and compass that Ivar had ferreted away onto his boat in hopes of protecting him. Floki tosses them both overboard because Floki does not do half measures.
No, he's all in. He's all in. If he's going to get out on a toy boat out on the open sea by himself with a limited amount of supplies, I might add, he's just going to be all in on that. No, like you said, half measure.
So we have a quick scene with Harald and Halfdan to discuss. Halfdan explains to his brother why he must now leave with Beren instead of Harald. He has his dreams to attend to, and it is time to get out from under the shadow of Harald's ambition. Harald doesn't even know what Halfdan's dreams are after all this time of being virtually inseparable. For the first time, I had a thought where I wished I was more like Halfdan, which is just fucking amazing that I had that thought, but I would not have been able to control myself. I would have said, "See what a dick you are?" But Halfdan does not do that.
Halfdan plays it cool. He plays it cool, and he was like, I'm going to be king of all Norway. And he's like, yeah, but my ambition is not to be the brother of the guy who's king of all of Norway. You know, I want something else from that. You know what I'm saying? Like, okay, so maybe it's not so bad to be the king or the king's brother. You know, you wake up every morning, you kind of get some breakfast, get some ale, maybe have some sex, maybe even consensual sex. Who knows? You know, in this guy's case. But that can't be your ambition in life. That can't be the only thing that you aspire to. So he wants to do something. He wants to sail to the ends of the known earth. And, you know, him and Bjorn are on the same page.
Well, this is a theme that comes up because you know, a lot of our characters are brothers in the show. Early on, we had Rollo complaining about being in Ragnar's shadow all the time. And I think that's also going to be something that's addressed with the Ragnarssons as well. So I think that's a very common experience between brothers, if not also sisters. I mean, I think it happens with sisters too.
Yeah. I mean, I have a sister, but there's no third sibling. We're not particularly close. So it was, you know, mm-hmm. And our ages are enough apart to where it wasn't like that. But, you know, one of the things that he says, I don't know if you were going to say more about their conversation.
No, go ahead.
But he says, you know, who's going to, you know, brothers need to look out for each other and need to have each other's back. And I thought this was interesting for two reasons, because Halfdan's response was something to the effect of, no matter where I'm at, I will always have your back. You don't have to worry about that. I don't have to be next to you to do that. So that makes me think that this could be a red flag for what's going on with Bjorn, you know, because he's taking this guy with him, but his loyalties are not with Bjorn.
Like, he's going to follow through on that statement somehow.
Somehow.
While they're in the Mediterranean.
Right. Or he might try to. Who knows? Or it might happen. Nobody is safe.
Oh, man. Maybe he's going to be the one that takes out Lagertha where the marble walls are or whatever.
Yeah.
The marble palace or wherever she's supposed to die.
The seer, what the seer said. So then you know, the other side of that was kind of setting the stage for how we're supposed to look at brotherly relationships in this series, because he says, I will always have your back even when I'm not around. The Ragnarssons are all together besides Bjorn, but, you know, the three Ragnarssons from the same mother are all together and they don't have each other's back. You know, it's just fighting and bickering amongst them. So there's a good contrast going there that kind of makes you think, okay, where are we going? Because Hurst really, you know, good with that kind of
stuff.
He likes
the contrast.
Sprinkle it in here and there and make you think about it.
All right, Lagertha. Just when you think there will be no Lagertha this episode, and how dare they, we are suddenly in Kattegat watching Torvi training her son Guthrum. I guess this is the Viking version of a tickle fight. Instead, it involves axe and sword blades raining down on you, making you giggle.
Yeah. Like, I like how she says, you're almost getting too strong for me. Like, she's like, I could still kick your ass right now. But in a couple years, you know, you're going to have to find a new training partner.
A horn sounds, warning the villagers of incoming boats. Torvi runs to warn Lagertha. King Harald is now before Lagertha, sharing the good news. And Lagertha looks amazing. Her red.
Yes, she does.
Blood red dress. Eventually, Lagertha gets around to Aegle the Bastard and killing King Harald for his betrayal, for his ballsy move. Astrid has her sword blade now at Harald's throat. The episode ends with King Harald daring Lagertha to strike him down and that he wishes it.
So, like we said earlier, all in all, really great episode.
Yeah, great start to the season.
Yeah, came back strong. I don't blame anybody for having a little bit of doubt that, can the show really shoulder on without, you know, Ragnar? How are we going to do this? Are people going to still want to watch? And the answer is, well, if you don't want to watch, you should want to watch because the show is still here. And as much as I love that guy, I didn't miss him during this episode. I didn't feel like he was missing. Yeah. I felt like the story that was being told to me the whole time was compelling enough to not really worry about that.
Yeah, I didn't miss him either. I mean, it wasn't until my second watch that I thought about the child crying by itself and it's like, oh, Ragnar would have like been there picking that child up.
Yeah. So we end on the cliffhanger, you know, with Harald saying, go ahead, you know, cut me, see what happens. He's not afraid to die kind of thing. And so
it's a great ending, but I'm just reserving my thoughts till we talk about part two, honestly.
So we'll just do it that way.
I know we're kind of short shrifting Lagertha's scene here, but there's really not much more to add to it. Like, she looked amazing.
Everybody, all of the Kattegat women were looking on point in this, because even Joan Jett, you know, Astrid, she looked really good. And I haven't always thought that, you know what I mean?
Really? I thought like you...
Some of her hairstyles in the past have been a little bit unflattering in my opinion.
Okay.
Not that I'm a stylist or have any hair myself, but you know what I'm saying. It's just all boils down to taste. I've never thought she was not a good looking woman, but I think that she was really, you know, really well done up in this scene.
They keep upping the ante with the braids too, and Torvi's braids looked awesome.
Yeah, Torvi's braids were just, and I'm glad to see that she's healthy. We can talk about that.
Yeah, because Torvi's alive, but we knew it.
We knew it.
You and I knew it.
We knew it, but it's nice to see a vindication of that. And it, you know, it kind of gets weird about timelines. That's another thing that you like. How much time has elapsed between the last episode that we've seen? Because okay, unless you make the assumption that each part of the story was on its own somewhat separate timeline to where they weren't lining up with the events that you saw. So if you have an episode and you get the killing of Sigurd, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And then the next episode coming into the next season five, has him in his, you know, his death shroud or whatever you want to call it. Then there's, I guess that's not the right term. But anyway, you know what I'm saying.
Well, there's travel time because you got to get King Harald from England to Kattegat.
Yeah. But you,
so that adds to it.
Okay, yeah.
Maybe
yeah,
not true. Enough time necessarily for, you know, a punctured shoulder wound, whatever Torvi had going on.
Yeah, because she's play fighting with her son. She's doing training stuff. So she's healthy enough to do that, and she's laughing about it. She's not all slow and like, oh, don't hit my shoulder.
Or she's not like, yeah, it's my shoulder is the reason why you got me down. Or
yeah. If I was totally healthy, I would kick your ass.
All right, so we're going to go ahead and end this episode. We have two pieces of feedback that we'll cover at the end of part two. So stay tuned for that.
All right. This has been a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
And I am your host, Em.
Good night.